We can all set up this kind of caring environment in which thoughts and feelings can be freely expressed and encourage boys to experience childhood in an entirely natural way. By doing so, we allow our sons to talk, mourn, and grieve openly about the shame they may feel when they fail to live up to the boy code. By doing so, we show boys that we love them for who they really are. Myth number 3. Boys are toxic. The anti-boy. A third myth of boyhood follows from the first two, but it can be even more devastating. Not only does society see boys as prisoners of their biological makeup, boys will be boys, and as properly confined by the gender straitjacket, boys should be boys, but we also tend to believe that there is something inherently dangerous or toxic about boys, that they are psychologically unaware, emotionally unsocialized creatures. This myth adds a potentially damaging element to the social environment. Karen decided to send her daughter Allison to an all-girls school, but kept her son in a coeducational environment. The reason, she explained, was that her daughter needed to learn that all roles in society are open to women. Her son, on the other hand, needed to learn in the company of girls because they would help to make him more sensitive and polished. She was saying, in other words, that the presence of boys might have a toxic effect on her daughter, while girls could help mitigate the noxious disposition of her son. Barbara, another parent, put the same anti-boy sentiment a little more directly when she said, "Girls have a civilizing effect." Such views must be seen as discriminatory to boys, but they are seldom challenged by other parents or by teachers because of the prevalent myth that boys are, in fact, toxic. This myth manifests itself in both subtle and dramatic ways. When a 7-year-old boy impulsively plants a kiss on a somewhat unwilling female playmate, he is branded a sexual delinquent and suspended from school. A 5th-grade boy, coming directly from a sex education class, jokes with a girl that her sagging belt looks like a penis and gets accused of sexual harassment. It is as if we are in the midst of an irrational, society-wide backlash against boys and young men. Put aside for the moment the obvious double standard of how teenage girls who joke about the bulge in football players' pants are unlikely to be branded as sexual harassers, and ask why we have confused boys' childish exploratory play with adult predatory behavior. No doubt, some components of boys' and girls' play go beyond the bounds of acceptability and are deserving of redirection or even reprimand. Yet, when it is a boy involved, we seem to forget his need to play, experiment, and fail in order to grow. Instead, we respond as though he is a full-fledged aggressor. Truth number 3. Boys are empathic. Although empathy is considered to be one of the strongest attributes of girls, there is ample evidence that boys are highly empathic as well. An interesting study was conducted of boys raised in a 2-parent household in which the father was the primary emotionally nurturing parent. In addition to all the other typical traits of well-adjusted male children, self-confidence, exuberance, action orientation, these boys also showed a greater flexibility of personality and a positive attitude toward girls and the ability to connect with them. In other words, men are capable of raising their boy children to have empathy in all their relationships. Even when raised without a predominant female presence, boys can learn to be sensitive and to care deeply about other people, including girls, and their feelings. Seth's friends were just such boys. Seth was a slight 16-year-old who excelled at soccer. In his junior year in high school, he was elected co-captain of the varsity soccer team. Not only was he respected by his teammates, but he was a model student and high achiever. But Seth had a sadness in his eyes and an uncertainty in his bearing that seemed at odds with his popular and physically confident self. However, it was not difficult to see why he seemed to be bearing a burden. His mother, a warm and active woman named Cindy, had been diagnosed with a severe and rapidly growing form of breast cancer. The entire family, Seth, his 13-year-old sister Amy, his father, and Cindy herself, had met with Cindy's oncologist. Seth talked about that meeting with great emotion. His father, who owned an insurance business, had broken the ice by asking the doctor for some straight answers about Cindy's condition and her chances. "There's no good way to tell you this," said the doctor. "Your wife has a very serious form of breast cancer. We're going to do everything we can, but the average life expectancy from tumors like this is less than 5 years." The family rallied around Cindy as best they could. Seth seemed particularly able to provide her with special comfort and support. He was aided in his efforts by an unexpected source, the members of his soccer team. The boys pitched in, helping with the formidable day-to-day tasks of caring for a seriously ill person. They hosted a bake sale to raise funds for the hospital, donating the proceeds in her name. Perhaps most important, Seth's buddies offered him their shoulders to cry on, and cry on them he did. When his mother's hair fell out from chemotherapy, when radiation treatments didn't work, Seth wept openly, at lunch hour, at study hall, or on his way to soccer practice in the afternoons. By his side were one or two, sometimes three or four of his friends, tears streaming down their cheeks as well. His mother died 4 years later when Seth was a sophomore at Yale. Although the news came as no surprise, it still hit him like a fist in the chest. He remembers doubling up with pain, worrying that he couldn't make it through the funeral. That night he called his best buddy from high school, Bill, a student at Stanford. "Don't worry, Seth," Bill assured him. "We'll be there for you." Seth assumed that Bill meant that his friends would be thinking of him, there for him in spirit. But on the day of the funeral, almost all of the 25 young men who had composed Seth's soccer team showed up at the church to attend the funeral. Outside the church, they joined together in a circle of shared love and grief, poured out their sadness to one another, and gave Bill the strength he needed to get through the service. The priest remarked to me that he had never seen anything like this. "I'm struck not only by their open affection and caring," he told me, "but by the fact that this is coming from boys." "They're men now, Father," I replied, "real men." This is just one example of the kind of caring, deeply supportive, empathic behavior that boys can show for their loved ones, their parents, their friends, their families, and that I have seen boys display in a wide variety of situations and circumstances. Chapter 4. Action Love. How Boys Relate. "We're really not so different from girls," an adolescent boy, Tim, said. "We just do things a little differently." The Love and Yearnings of Real Boys. Boys are immensely loving, and they yearn for relationships far more than we have ever recognized. There are two reasons boys' inherent loving nature and their yearning for relationships go largely unnoticed by society. First, when boys relate in ways that are considered traditionally feminine, when they're tender and affectionate, when they are emotionally expressive, when they talk sensitively about difficult friendships, society often does not support them because it sees them as violating the boy code of masculine toughness and independence. Second, boys often relate in ways that many of us simply don't recognize as a means for expressing love. Boys approach friendships and express love differently from the way girls do, and too often we just don't get it, because we're so used to assuming that love can be expressed only through the traditional female models. And so we don't fully understand that boys are reaching out for human relationships when they actually are. As we'll learn in this chapter, though some boys show their love and caring in traditional ways, many have their own boy-like ways of doing so. First, rather than showing love through words, many boys do so through action. Thus, instead of declaring their love directly through words, many boys use indirect ways of conveying their feelings by doing things for or with other people. So, for example, rather than telling his mom how much he loves her on Mother's Day, the boy may instead simply ask her if she'd like to go to the movies with him that day. Boys also show love through acts of protection. When they see somebody they love in a vulnerable position or in trouble, they leap to the rescue and do whatever they can to help their friend or loved one through the situation. A third way that boys show love and form friendships is through work. Instead of using words to tell his parents that he cares deeply about them, a boy may signal the same feelings by offering to repair the leaky toilet, fix the roof, or drive his younger brother to his trumpet lesson. Finally, many boys express their love and their longing for human relationships through acts of justice and kindness. Whether it's helping an elderly person cross a busy city street, or sticking up for the rights of the first person of color to come to his all-white high school, a boy may often show his love and caring by standing up for what he believes is right, good, and fair. Love through action. Even at a very young age, boys may show their love not so much with words, but through action. The early ability to attach, in the terminology of psychologists, refers to a child's capacity to develop intimate, powerful emotional bonds to others, such as his mother and father and his peers. Research shows that boys have this ability as much as girls do, yet their typical attachment styles often differ from those of girls. For example, boys and girls show their feelings toward their parents in very different ways. A girl might seek connection with her mother by snuggling up beside her, kissing her, smoothing her hair, or just talking with her. A boy is more likely to ask his mother to do something, to play a game, give him a ride. Or he might express love indirectly, give her a playful nudge and then run away, hoping, of course, that she'll give chase. An adolescent girl might seek connection with her mother by giving her a hug or bringing her a small gift for no particular reason or occasion. An adolescent boy typically tries to make connection by offering to help his mother with some task that he normally avoids, taking out the trash, cleaning up his room, agreeing to an errand, or doing his own laundry. Or he may suggest some activity they can do together, such as taking a bike ride together or going to a movie. A girl may seek attachment with her father by asking for help on her homework. A boy in the same family might tease his father, an indirect way of showing love, or initiate a wrestling match. Similarly, boys and girls often approach other close caregivers, such as teachers, in substantially different ways. While a young girl might seek attachment with her schoolteacher by complimenting the teacher on her special outfit, a young boy might make a connection with the teacher by asking whether he can stay after class and help out by erasing the blackboards. On the whole, boys tend to seek attachment less through asking for it directly and more by trying to bring it about indirectly or through action. Love in Action, Mrs. Kozlowski's Class. Mrs. Kozlowski was flabbergasted when the boys in her all-boys English class began asking her questions about her upcoming wedding. She recounted a striking story about how boys' love is expressed through action. "I already knew these boys were gutsy to take a class devoted to poetry, but this I never expected." The boys had become concerned that she be able to take time off to buy the matching shoes and veil to go with the wedding dress, which she had not been able to do. So they volunteered to clean up the classroom and read extra chapters in their textbooks so that she could take the day off. Two of the boys offered to go with her. "I knew they cared," she said, "but I never imagined they'd feel so close to me that these concerns would matter to them, too." Mothers, too, report ways in which boys use action to promote closeness. Mrs. Schwartz told me the following story about how her son Jamie connects with her each day. A serious student and captain of his local soccer club at age 14, Jamie takes time every morning to send a loving email message from the school library computer. And every afternoon during halftime, he calls her up to check up on how her day at work is going. "He knows this new job at the hospital is very stressful, and we're so close, he just wants me to know he's thinking of me." "When he was born," Mrs. Schwartz continued, "his grandmother told me he's a beautiful child, but boys just don't think of their mothers the way girls do once they're grown up. I prayed my mother would be wrong, and now I know that she was." Boys show their yearnings for attachment in a unique way, but as different as their attachment styles may sometimes be, boys, like girls, benefit enormously from both feminine and masculine forms of mentoring, and they rely significantly on their connection to the women and men who raise and educate them. The indirect approach and its use with friends. To initiate or deepen a friendship, girls may tend to do so directly through open verbal communication, but boys may take an indirect route through an action or activity of some kind, as in the case of Brian. Wanting to be friends with David, Brian might plan an activity and offhandedly ask David if he wants to come along or join in, acting as if it doesn't really matter whether David accepts. The activity may be a game of pickup basketball, a saxophone rehearsal, or simply hanging out at the local hub. Though the approach looks different, the feelings behind it, the longing for closeness, are the same. Little boys, too, may seek emotional bonds in indirect ways. With other boys, these bonds may be forged through exuberant, rough-and-tumble play. With girls, they may start with teasing, a method of seeking connection that is usually motivated far less by malice than by a fundamental desire to stir up possibilities for friendship. And sometimes boys may surprise us with how innovative they can be in drumming up relationships. Consider, for example, the other creative approaches by Jason and Aaron discussed below. A guy place. Jason, a four-letter man, he qualified for four varsity sports in high school, had proposed that the school set up a place where the boys in his class could create an after-school peer support group talk center. There are so many pressures on us and no place to talk. I thought if we had a guy place with rules that no one could come there and poke fun at what anyone said, just listen and help, it might help take a load off us. Jason's school implemented his idea, and soon the idea was so popular that extra groups had to be added. Mr. Hanratty, the school principal, commented to me, "Who would have thought that boys would want their own space to relate?" Aaron Spencer, another high school student, created his own relationship-building project. Tired of hearing all the ranking down of the nerds, bright but slightly weird science whizzes in the 10th grade, Aaron, as class president, decided to create a forum with representatives of girls and guys, popular and unpopular, brains, jocks, feminists, cheerleaders, nerds, artsies, liberals, and conservatives. He brought them all together to talk and encourage them to form relationships that transcended their basic differences. Aaron's program, it turned out, was a great success, but perhaps the most striking result was that Aaron found a new friend, Jake, a science nerd. "We just got to talking at the forum," Aaron said. "Then we went to a movie, and now we do all kinds of stuff together. I've really learned that to find a true friend, you've got to stretch yourself a little." As these stories reveal, boys, if we read their signals correctly, and if we encourage them, not only want to form close relationships, but actually are often very creative and successful in doing so. Habits of thought in society confuse us into imagining that close relationships are not central to boys' normal growth and development, and that a boy's only possible path to healthy adult masculinity is through self-reliance, autonomy, and solitude. Yet, in reality, boys yearn for close relationships just as much as girls do. Protective love. Boys' love and protectiveness may show themselves through a unique form of action. One middle school teacher told me the following story. One of his students, Jeremy, heard a rumble of voices in the cafeteria that sounded like an argument in progress. He ambled over, shouldered through the crowd, and saw two girls in the middle of the group screaming at each other, both shaking with anger and on the brink of physical violence. One of the girls was Jeremy's sister, Cassie, a freshman. The other girl, Tara, was a junior, a bigger girl and one of the most popular kids in school. In fact, Jeremy had dated her a couple of times and had wanted to continue the relationship, but Tara had started going out regularly with a senior. The situation was a difficult one for Jeremy. He cared for his sister, but she was very independent and might not appreciate his getting involved in the argument. He also had little interest in making a scene in front of Tara. Everybody knew that he liked her, and that she had dumped him. He didn't want any more embarrassment, but the argument was getting more intense, and he knew that Tara, who was a weight trainer and center of the girls' basketball team, could do some real physical damage to Cassie if she felt like it. The confrontation had reached the breaking point. Rather than allow his sister to get involved in a fight, Jeremy stepped into the center of the circle. "Hey, Tara!" he shouted. Tara looked at him, startled. "What do you want?" "Want to go out Saturday night?" Jeremy asked her. Tara was thrown off balance. I told you I didn't want to go out with you anymore, Tara said. The crowd tittered nervously. No, I guess you'd rather beat on my little sister, he said calmly. The crowd laughed with him. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I would, taunted Tara. It's more fun than making out with you. A big laugh from the crowd. But Tara, what did Cassie do that makes you want to fight her? It's none of your business, Tara replied. Okay, I just can't imagine why someone as smart as you would want to beat up a freshman. Why can't you talk it out? Just stay out of this, Tara insisted, and turned back to Cassie. Jeremy looked at his sister. She was holding her ground, but he could tell she wouldn't mind some help in getting out of her predicament. Jeremy simply took her by the arm. Come on, he said to her. This is stupid. Let's go. The two made their way through the crowd, leaving Tara behind. She watched them go, and the crowd wondered what she would do. Finally, she spoke with a grudging admiration. If he loves his sister that much, maybe he's not so bad after all. The crowd broke up with laughter. As they walked away, Cassie said to her brother, I could have handled that. I know, said Jeremy. But thanks. That was really nice of you. I had to do it, he smiled. You're my sister. I love you, don't I? I guess you do, Cassie said, marveling, never having really thought about it. You might expect a brother to protect his sister, especially a younger one, but in today's climate a boy may feel too constrained to express this kind of protective love. He may fear that he will be criticized for being too macho, or think that no boy should presume to intervene in an altercation between two girls. But Jeremy felt he had no choice but to get involved and show his love and support for his sister, and he found a way to do so that did not make her seem foolish or incapable. Another boy, Kim, expressed a similar kind of protective love, in this case for a neighbor with a serious illness. When I was 10, Kim told me, I volunteered to help take care of my neighbor kid down the street, named Michael. He had something wrong with his spine and had to be in a body cast for a whole year. I didn't really know him, but his mother asked my mother if I could come over and just say hi, and I said okay. When I first saw Mike, I thought the whole thing was really weird and I wanted to go home. I thought we could never be friends. He's sick and can't walk. But then we discovered that we both liked playing that card game, Magic. That was about the only thing Mike could do besides watch TV. Once we started playing and I got to know him better, I liked him. So then I really started looking after him. Sometimes I would just go over and read to him. He couldn't walk, but he liked going outside in this cart-like thing, so I'd push him around the driveway and down the street sometimes. If anybody looked strangely at him, I'd give them the evil eye back. If anybody said anything bad about him at school or laughed at him, I'd tell them to shut up and say that he was a really good kid. Kim found it rewarding to be able to help and protect his friend. He felt very close to Mike and showed it by helping him and defending him to others. It made me feel really good about myself, said Kim. Part of being a friend is letting other people know it. Love is the core of each and every boy. Expressing Love Through Work, Mrs. Summers. Another way boys and men express their feelings for others is through engaging in what we call work. A boy's inclination to do hard work and willingness to take on duty and responsibilities, virtues traditionally celebrated as masculine, may be shaped into a strong motivation not only for improving academic performance, but also for caring for others in a disciplined way. Just as men will work toward a goal that they believe will please or protect a loved one, boys will undertake a project or a task as a way of expressing affection. Though sometimes we may focus only on the task that's being accomplished, we should be aware that behind the labor, there's often the devotion of a boy engaged in what's truly an act of selfless generosity, an act of love. Bob and Tim had always liked Mrs. Summers, one of the most involved and thoughtful fifth-grade teachers at King Elementary School. She liked to regale her students with stories of her vacation adventures and always brought back some sort of live animal to show the class. Over the years, the classroom came to look like a zoo, filled with cages containing small furry creatures with Latin names the boys could not remember. Mrs. Summers joked that if she brought in any more animals, the children would have to go. It was a warm, inviting, caring, and nurturing environment. One winter weekend, vandals sneaked into the school. When Mrs. Summers' students arrived in class Monday morning, they found the room in a shambles. Most of the animals had been let out of their cages and had escaped. Others had been killed. Mrs. Summers was devastated, as were the kids. They talked about what had happened and why. During the day, a few of the girls used photos of the animals to make a collage and pinned them up on the bulletin board. Other students talked about having a party to cheer up Mrs. Summers. But Tim and Bob came up with a different idea. Both boys did odd jobs in their neighborhoods, shoveling snow, mowing lawns, walking dogs, and babysitting. They each managed to save about $5 a week, which they deposited in their own checking accounts. They had promised their parents they would save the money to help with the cost of their college educations. The boys' first thought was to withdraw the money and give it to Mrs. Summers to buy some new animals. But after some discussion, they decided that it wouldn't make sense to spend all their hard-earned money, and besides, they had made a promise to their parents. Finally, they came up with a clever idea. They realized that they had more time in their weekly schedules that they could devote to work. They enlisted several other boys from their class and made posters advertising their services. Their earnings would go to the Summers Wildlife Fund, established to restock the animal kingdom in Mrs. Summers' fifth-grade classroom. They even created a website that detailed their services and enabled their classmates to follow their progress. For 3 months, Bob, Tim, and their friends devoted every Saturday and Sunday afternoon to do the work for the Wildlife Fund. By June, they had accumulated $75. On the last day of school, the boys surprised Mrs. Summers with a check. She was overwhelmed. "You boys are unbelievable," she exclaimed, hugging them, tears streaming down her cheeks. "I have never seen such a hard-working, caring bunch of guys." Bob and Tim felt tremendous joy that their hard work had been appreciated by a person they cared very much about. Bob and Tim had found a way to express their love for Mrs. Summers through action, a way to use their inclination to do hard work to benefit another person. And she received their message very clearly. $75, even for a public school teacher, did not represent a significant sum of money. But 3 months of free time spent on work by five young boys represented not only a real sacrifice, but a tremendous investment of love and energy, all for her benefit. No wonder she wept. It's important for parents, for all of us, to be aware that boys often choose to express their love through action and work, and to recognize and respond to it when they do. When father and son team up to create a homeless project for scouts, or when brothers tackle a snowed-in driveway together for a disabled neighbor, we are seeing the traditional male work ethic buttressed by a demonstration of love and affection. Dedication to justice as a form of caring. Another way boys show love that often falls outside stereotypical expectations is through their strong sense of fairness and justice. Boys will often sacrifice their own personal interests in an effort to be fair to others, especially those they care most about. This characteristic often surprises me when I encounter it. "Yeah, I really wanted to go to the game," a boy will tell me. "But my mother needed me to look after my sister." It was fair, because she left in the middle of a dinner party last weekend to care for me when I got that terrible flu. When boys analyze their own behavior in light of what is fair and just for all involved, they are showing how important their relationships are to them, and that they are willing to put aside their personal interests to sacrifice in order to maintain an emotional connection with someone they love, respect, or wish to protect, or to defend a principle that affects the quality of people's lives. Take, for instance, Eric, a boy who sought me out when he was facing what he saw as a moral dilemma. Eric was trying to decide whether to cut school to attend a demonstration in Washington, D.C., against the proposed American military involvement in Iraq. A loving son and an excellent student, he cared deeply about issues of politics and ethics. His parents had brought him up to do what was right, as well as to do good. And although they didn't disagree with him on the issue itself, they did not want him to miss school and attend the demonstration. He would be holding a placard and handing out flyers. "Why do they need you to do that work?" his mother asked. "Anyone could do it." "It could be dangerous," added his father. "You could be tear-gassed. There might be a riot." Eric was tormented by his decision. On the one hand, he felt very strongly about the prospect of innocent women and children being killed if the United States were to attack Iraq. At the same time, he did not wish to go against his parents' wishes. He loved them and understood their point of view. He discussed his decision with his two sisters. They, too, were disturbed by the situation and felt tremendous empathy with the Iraqi people who would be the innocent victims. But Eric didn't feel the urge to cry or talk about the problem. He felt, instead, a deep urge to right the wrong that he believed was being perpetrated. He wanted to show his empathy through action. "I hope you can help me sort these things out," Eric said to me. "I really feel like I've got to stick to what's right. As my dad used to say, actions speak louder than words." The sense of justice, of moral responsibility, with which he had been imbued since childhood, had welled up inside him, and he felt forced to take action in this Iraq protest. The potential damage to his honors record as a result of skipping school and the struggle with his loving family would have to take second place to his sense of justice and of what he felt was right. Like Eric, many boys express their sense of fairness by trying to solve problems, by making decisions, and especially by taking swift, decisive action. Girls sometimes express their sense of fairness quite differently. For instance, by speaking about their feelings with adults or by talking among themselves about their sense of outrage. Adults sometimes expect the same kinds of behavior from boys, and thus misinterpret boys' justice-seeking actions as mere bravado. When we observe boys closely, we discover that many of them feel strongly about making a difference in the lives of the people for whom they care deeply, and about doing what's right for them. They do this, in most cases, by planning and implementing hands-on, proactive measures, their own way of showing love through action. Real boys show a loving respect for girls. When given proper support, boys develop a loving respect for others in general, as well as a platonic affection for the opposite gender in particular. In coeducational peer settings, in which they feel pressured to compete against one another for the attention of girls, boys may sometimes behave, on the surface at least, as though they do not respect girls. In these settings, for instance, boys may tease girls, taunt them, or brag to other boys about their interactions with girls or women. But when they are placed in an environment where they believe they won't be harassed for showing respect to girls, or in a gender-sensitive all-boys environment, such as a boys' school or the Boy Scouts, where they are temporarily freed from the pressure to compete over girls, many boys can come to understand and empathize with what makes girls and women feel vulnerable and unsafe. If properly encouraged, boys show a natural inclination to honor these feelings in girls and women with compassion and respect. In my interview with Guy, a 16-year-old honors student from an all-boys school, he explained to me that Ellen, the girl he had met at a dance through his younger sister, was first and foremost a good friend. There had been some romantic stirrings on both sides, but Ellen, he specified, was very nervous about touching, and I could tell she wanted her space, so we'd just talk. But the talking was more than he had ever imagined. Ellen has a way of listening, of caring about what I say, that I never thought I'd find. She makes me feel so good about myself, like I really matter. And it makes me want to share with her, too. It's a new thing for me, and it's great. "Have you told the other guys about Ellen?" I asked Guy. "Some of the other guys understand. They have girls they're close to, but it's not romantic. Not girlfriends. Some guys tease me. They push me to tell them if we're making out, having sex. I let them know it's none of their business. Ellen's a great girl, and I'm lucky to know her. And for now, that's just fine with me." Many boys are less solid than Guy, and often try to fool themselves and others into thinking that girls are just objects to be taken advantage of. Do they really believe it? In many cases, the answer is no. The pressure to be cool, tough, and together pushes many adolescent boys and young men to hide their deepest connected feelings, mask the empathy that comes naturally to them, and instead assume the roles of unthinking sexual predators. If we remove that pressure from boys' lives, I believe they would feel safer to express their inherent respect for girls and women, and their yearning to relate closely and meaningfully with them. Each boy's voice is unique. There is not one single healthy path to mature masculinity. Boys' self-esteem, which is, of course, as essential to their emotional growth and academic achievement as it is to girls, is dependent not upon macho displays of competitive aggression, but on having their real voices heard and genuine selves responded to with deep understanding. If we offer comfort zones free of shame and humiliation, If we let them know that all of their attributes and yearnings are not only acceptable but cherished, we discover sides of our boys that we never knew existed. The boy we always thought was shy delivers a Shakespeare soliloquy with exuberance and conviction. The boy who never before had felt close to his father reaches out to him and makes a new, strong connection. The boy everyone had branded as a troublemaker breaks down in tears and speaks for the first time of his abusive alcoholic mother and how lonely and afraid he feels. When we really give boys the chance to share everything they're thinking about and hoping for, when we work to understand the diverse ways they use to show their yearnings for closeness and connection, whether they use more traditional feminine approaches or some of the special ways of loving others discussed in this chapter, and when we give them our full, non-judgmental support to pursue exactly what they want for themselves, their masks finally come off, and we begin to discover the virtues of our real boys. It's then, too, that we realize that so much of what boys do for and with us is more than just random boyish activity. It's the way that so many of them relate, the way that they love. Real boys like Kevin. One final story of how boys express action love. Kevin Loringer, a lanky, blonde-haired 12-year-old boy, was playing with his two best buddies, John Jr. and Charlie, along a sandy California beach that was deserted that morning. The surf was dangerously high, way too high for swimming, as the lifeguard's red warning flag indicated at the rescue station just 1 mile up the road. Charlie, a freckle-faced redhead and the most daring of the group, challenged the three amigos, as they were called by their parents, to strip off their clothes and jump in for a swim. Before Kevin could object, Charlie had plunged into the surf. John Jr., hesitant and uneasy, and Kevin, weighing the risks involved, suddenly heard cries of Charlie's distress. Kevin could see waves crashing on the shore and Charlie, his arms flailing, bobbing up and down. "Help! Help!" Charlie shouted, his voice shrill. Kevin yelled over to John to run for help, and without any apparent thought for his own safety, yanked off his shoes and ran to the water, diving into the surf toward his friend in trouble. With massive effort, several times almost succumbing to the choppy waves himself, Kevin managed to drag Charlie out of the surf and pull him onto the beach. He looked at Charlie and found he was barely breathing. Images of their past moments together flashed through Kevin's mind. The time they wandered off on a Boy Scout hike and spent a cold night in the Sierra Nevada. The cool, breezy Sunday afternoon, their Little League team won the local championships. The time Charlie's sister, Amelia, was dying from leukemia, and he stood by as Charlie cried in the waiting room of Mount Zion Hospital. While these images came to him, he cleared Charlie's mouth of water and began to perform mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Happily, he was soon interrupted by the paramedics, who ran up to him along with John Jr. Kevin was interviewed later that day on the 10 o'clock news. Bashfully, Kevin answered the reporter's question of how he'd had the courage to risk his own life to save his friend. "It wasn't anything, really," he said. "Charlie's my best buddy, and when he needed help, I just did what I had to do. I'm sure he'd do the same for me. And the mouth-to-mouth, well, that's what Coach Larson had taught on the swim team, and I just followed his instructions exactly. I'm sure glad everybody's okay." While in some ways Kevin's story celebrates some of the traditional virtues of boys that we often take for granted, their enormous energy, how they revel in physical contact, their ability to compete with admirable gusto, it also reflects many of the kinds of love we've been discussing. Kevin takes action to show his love for Charlie. He's loyal to his friends and will do whatever it takes to protect them. Boys, this story tells us, will risk their lives for a buddy. Boys, it assures us, very much need friends and will put their lives on the line to keep them. Part 2. Connecting to Boys. Night and day arrive, and day after day goes by, and what is old remains old, and what is young remains young and grows old. The lumber pile does not grow younger, nor the 2x4s lose their darkness. But the old tree goes on. The barn stands without help so many years. The advocate of darkness and night is not lost. The horse steps up, swings on one leg, turns his body. The chicken flapping claws up onto the roost, its wings whelping and walloping. But what is primitive is not to be shot out into the night and the dark. And slowly the kind of man comes closer, loses his rage, sits down at table. So I am proud only of those days that pass in undivided tenderness, when you sit drawing or making books, stapled, with messages to the world, or coloring a man with fire coming out of his hair, or we sit at a table with small tea carefully poured. So we pass our time together, calm and delighted. Robert Bly, For My Son Noah, 10 years old. Chapter 5. The Power of Mothers. I don't think I'd be much without her. Clint Westfield, age 15. Never too much of a good thing. Mothers help make boys into men. Contrary to society's traditional misgivings about a close relationship between mother and son, I find that, in reality, boys benefit tremendously from the love of their mothers, especially the kind of unshaming parenting we've been discussing as the way to bring out the best in boys. I believe that by empowering the mother, you empower the son. And I believe empowered mothers are a key to resolving society's confusion about masculinity and creating a new real boy code. Far from making boys weaker, the love of a mother can and does actually make boys stronger emotionally and psychologically. Far from making boys dependent, the base of safety a loving mother can create, a connection that her son can rely on all his life, provides a boy with the courage to explore the outside world. But most important, far from making a boy act in girl-like ways, a loving mother actually plays an integral role in helping a boy develop his masculinity, the self-esteem and strength of character he needs to feel confident in his own masculine self. The double standard of masculinity. In our contemporary world, the old boy code still holds our sons to a double standard of masculinity. On the one hand, boys are told they should act in tough, conventionally guy-like ways. And on the other, they are chastised when they don't act sensitive, caring, or empathic enough. My research shows that amid these confusing double messages to boys, it is often a boy's empathic, active, undaunted mother who is in the best position to help him reconcile these conflicting messages about who he should become and how he should or shouldn't behave. In other words, it is mothers, the first women who are deeply involved in the emotional lives of most boys, who are in fact the earliest teachers of today's masculinity. It is they who first instruct boys about how to integrate both components of our split model of masculinity, and who therefore imbue boys with a sense of confidence about the wash of feelings, behavior, and experiences that add up to being an emotionally balanced and satisfied man. Then, too, it's generally the mother who is still mainly responsible for creating a home, that warm, loving environment to which a boy can retreat when his spirits run low or when the outside world seems overwhelming. As we'll see in the next chapter, most fathers have a special ability to bond with their sons through high-energy activities that teach them how to stretch their capacity for handling the intensity of such experiences. Most mothers, by contrast, seem to connect with their sons just by being with them, by giving them their undivided attention, and by making themselves available as an unfailing source of love, comfort, and support. As discussed in Part 1, I don't think a boy's separation from mother at a very early age, and again at adolescence, should ever be sanctioned. Instead, I believe that mothers should be encouraged to trust their own instincts over society's misgivings, that the love of a mother, in most cases, is what will help a boy launch himself into a healthy masculine life. My research also shows that the absence of a close relationship with a loving mother puts a boy at a disadvantage in becoming a free, confident, and independent man, a man who likes himself and can take risks and who can form close and loving attachments with people in his adult life. In their early years, as well as during adolescence, I think a boy will benefit enormously from spending time in the loving environment created by his mother and her friends, the happy, nurturing world of women. So I'm in favor of more of mother, not less, especially at those times in a boy's life when our culture typically pushes for the premature separation of boy from mother. Clint, a strong boy who still needs mom. Clint Westfield, age 15, speaks passionately about how his mother gives him strength and courage to face the future. "When I start freaking out, it's my mom who puts down everything and comes around to help me. She explains things to me, you know, comforts me, and then I feel strong again. Like sometimes I'm so upset I don't want to go outside anymore. I just want to go hide in my room. My mom tells me that what I'm going through is normal. After we spend some time together, or sometimes we hang out with some of her friends in the neighborhood, I feel like I can go outside again to be with my friends." "What makes you afraid in the first place?" I asked, surprised by the candor of this tall, well-built teenager, who looked as if he was probably the biggest and strongest kid on his block. "My dad. I mean, my dad's the best, but he's an agent with the FBI, and lots of times he leaves really early in the morning to go on these dangerous missions. I get nervous, and so does my mom, because he puts on his body armor and wears a gun on his belt. He tells us these wild stories at night. Friends of his have been wounded. I love his stories, but they get us worried because his life is just about always on the line. Sometimes Dad just goes to work in an office, and I don't have anything to worry about. But on the days when he wears his body armor, I know something bad might happen. When I go into his bedroom and the armor is missing from his closet, I know something's up." "Have you ever spent a day at work with your dad?" "It's not allowed. But anyway, I don't want to be an FBI agent. My grandfather was an agent, and now my dad is too." So is there pressure on you to become an agent? That must make you scared, too. Well, I look up to my father a lot, and in some ways he probably wishes I'd become an agent. But my mom tells me that I can do whatever I want. When we talk about my future, she always says, "You don't have to be just like your father and take risks and put your life on the line to be a man. You can be just as much a man by being yourself and doing whatever seems the easiest and the most fun for you. That is what you should do." That sounds pretty fair. Yep, my mom's pretty cool. She always knows what to say to make me feel good about myself. I don't think I'd be much without her. So do you have an idea of what you'd like to do in the future? I'm thinking about law school. Maybe I'll become a criminal lawyer. I like the whole law enforcement world, as long as I don't have to go through what my dad does. But I'm not really thinking so much about careers these days. That makes sense, I told Clint. Yeah, he explained. I'm more worried about finding the right girl. If I could find someone just like my mom, I'd be golden. Clint's story is important, I believe, because it shows how his mother could not only talk openly with her son and help him deal with his most vulnerable emotions, but also be instrumental in helping him to feel confident, to feel he's a good, competent, normal boy. Moreover, by encouraging him to choose whatever kind of career he'd like, despite the family history of FBI work, she also gives Clint the message that he can become a man according to his own definition. What's a Mother to Do? The Boy of the Future. Fortunately, many of today's mothers are no mindless enforcers of gender stereotypes. After all, this generation of mothers was raised in the bracing atmosphere of feminism. Many have embraced the ideal of equality between the sexes, struggled to rediscover their own voices, and to find qualities of toughness, assertiveness, and competitiveness within themselves. Today's mothers have successfully battled for the right to work, think, and compete as men do. They have battled for the right of their daughters to be outspoken and strong, to succeed in math class, even to play football if they want to. And at home, these women have struggled with their male companions to rework their most intimate relationships on a more equal basis. Today's mothers demand from their partners more than help with the diapering and vacuuming. They want empathy and sensitivity. Yet I find that these women, who are so confident about so many gender issues, are frequently still unsure of themselves when it comes to raising their own sons. Time after time, women have voiced to me their doubts and confusion. Yes, they say, we want to raise boys who are sensitive to others, who can play with girls, who are aware of their vulnerable emotions and not afraid to express them. But, they add, we also don't want to raise a boy who will be branded as a wimp, who will have to endure teasing and beatings from other boys, who will have no friends and no dates in high school. How can we raise a son to be the kind of sensitive man we'd want to have a relationship with, and still have him survive the relentless peer pressure of grade school and the adolescent years? How far ahead of the gender curve can we be, they wonder. Mothers who try to ignore gender stereotypes often find they have a rocky road. Society is quick to let them know that the old boy code is still in effect, that mothers too must abide by the rules. Whether it's a little boy who runs home crying when his peers tease him about his long curly hair, the adolescent who complains that mom's alternative dispute resolution techniques just aren't working at school, or the husband or other family member who implores her to stop trying to make the boy so sweet, a mother receives constant outside reminders that she must comply with society's rules about boys and masculinity. Ellen and Jack. Take, for example, Ellen, who discovered that her husband, Jack, was concerned about her relationship with their son. When I first got to know them, they were struggling over how to set limits for Christopher, their 14-year-old son. Each of them was advocating a different way of disciplining the boy when he was acting out. But as Ellen and Jack talked things through with each other, they realized that underneath the problem of discipline was a more volatile, more emotionally charged difference of opinion. Ellen and Jack disagreed over the boy code's rules about tenderness between mother and son and what this might mean for Christopher's development. "You let Christopher get away with murder," Jack said to Ellen, "especially with all that hugging in public. He's all over you like a monkey in heat. It's so inappropriate." Ellen responded with passion. "It's one of the most wonderful things about our son. In this world of guns and TV violence, Christopher can still show his love openly by hugging me and his friends. We should reward that, encourage this gentle, loving side." I attempted to empathize with both, to support Ellen in her courageous stance and to help her husband understand its benefits. Jack grudgingly agreed that he would want his son to be well loved by Ellen. Yet Jack was unable to let go of his fears for the boy's masculinity and his nagging sense that there was something inappropriate about their physical show of affection. Grace and Dino. Mothers tell me they feel pressured to cut off their close relationships with their sons from many sources, both intimate and institutional. Peers, teachers, coaches, in-laws, grandparents, and fathers. But years of psychological research confirm what we all know, that the more love small children receive from their mothers, the more confidence they gain in themselves as individuals. A mother's love can help a boy become more self-reliant and more adventurous. Study after study has shown that small children who have a close relationship with their primary caregiver, so-called securely attached children, are psychologically healthier and stronger. The more nurturing children receive, the braver they can be. Secure attachments to mother, concluded Megan Gunner at the University of Minnesota, work as a buffer against new, frightening situations. And Gunner's colleague, Alan Struff, found that those who in their infancy were securely attached to their mothers may enjoy greater self-reliance, have lower rates of psychopathology, do better at school, and have higher self-esteem throughout their lives. Yet, in the face of society's relentless pressure to make them disconnect from their sons, even the most nurturing of mothers feel the need to limit their love. Grace, a mother of two sons, spoke to me of the guilt and confusion she felt. "My first boy and I were as close as any two humans could be. It was a difficult pregnancy and a tough few months after birth, but we felt really bonded. Then, when Alexander turned 4, I'd noticed that sometimes he'd get an erection when he was in the bathroom with me. I got worried. Was I doing something wrong? Something hurtful?" "How did you handle that, the worry you had?" I asked Grace. "I turned to my husband, Dino, but he wasn't much help. Both he and his parents seemed like they were out to get me."
"What do you mean, exactly?"
"Well, Dino just told me, 'Of course, what do you expect? You baby him too much. He still has that baby doll you bought him years ago. If we don't do something right away, he'll turn into a sissy. You've got to give him more space. I'll sign him up for karate classes, and when he asks you to hold him on your lap or in bed at night, try to discourage it.
at least a little.
And his parents told me I should stop babying Alexander.
And how did that feel for you?
Well, I followed all the advice, and Alex did seem a little more independent. He said goodbye at preschool with less fuss, stopped asking to have me wash his hair in the tub, and forgot all about that doll set when his dad bought him a Batman costume. But somehow in his eyes and in my own heart I could perceive a subtle sadness, like a little flickering light had gone out. He's in college now, a fine, healthy young man, but our relationship is